Hey, it's Jen. Just a quick heads up before we start the show. The news is rapidly developing and things may have changed by the time you hear this episode. For the latest news, tune into your public radio station and follow updates at npr.org. This is 1A. I'm Jen White in Washington, and you're listening to the News Roundup. Here to help us unpack is Shane Harris. He covers national security and intelligence for The Washington Post. Shane, it's always great to have you.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Also with us, Eva McKend, the congressional correspondent for Spectrum News. Eva, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
And Dan Diamond. He covers health policy for The Washington Post. Hey, Dan.
Jen, glad to be back.
So half of all American adults are now fully vaccinated, and President Biden still wants 70% of all Americans fully vaccinated by July. Dan, do you think we can get there?
Jen, we look clearly on track to hit President Biden's goal of 70% of American adults who've gotten at least one shot by July 4th. Partly that's because the number of Americans who can be vaccinated has expanded to younger groups, and we have finally inched over that key mark of half of all Americans getting shots, though it took a little longer than expected. It took about as long to go from 40% to 50% as it did to go from 20% to 40%.
What do we know about who's in that unvaccinated 50% right now?
Well, it's a mix of different populations. They defy easy categorization. Some are folks who just still at this point haven't had easy availability to shots. Maybe they're working shift work where it's been hard to schedule appointments. They're more amenable to getting a shot at a place that just allows them to drop in. There are some Americans who still have questions about the long-term effects, the potential side effects from these new vaccines. They're waiting to see how it bears out for others. And then there are still some Americans who just don't want to get these shots at all. Many of them are Trump supporters. They see this entire campaign as tinged with politics. So there are different tactics to try and reach all these different groups. And it's been very interesting to see some of the incentive campaigns that states have set up, whether they're lotteries or other awards and prizes. They do seem to be moving the dial in some states. And there are a variety of other efforts trying to win over people one shot at a time.
Well, Moderna is the latest vaccine maker to ask the FDA to expand use of its vaccine to teenagers. How did teens and kids fit into this overall vaccination effort and the goal the president has set?
So Moderna, which is one of the big vaccine makers, they did a phase two, phase three trial of its vaccine with several thousand adolescents. The results looked quite good, as they have for older populations. Moderna did say that they're going to be asking the FDA in the coming days to widen who's eligible for its shot. I think one reason this fits in, Jen, is we are trying as a nation to get as many people covered against this pandemic so we can return to pre-pandemic normalcy. And there are lots of parents who don't want their kids to go back to school, who are worried about potentially kids who are immunocompromised. They want that protection for their children. I will say, as we are vaccinating more and more younger people, healthier populations in America, and we know that teens, that kids aren't really that vulnerable to coronavirus, there is some resentment brewing in the international health community, as so many people abroad have yet to get shots, and unvaccinated health workers are even dying abroad.
We're talking to Dan Diamond of The Washington Post, Eva McKend of Spectrum News, and Shane Harris, also of The Washington Post. Shane, this week, President Biden ordered intelligence agencies to reexamine a theory into the origins of COVID-19. What is this theory?
So this theory is that the SARS coronavirus that causes COVID-19 actually either was already inside of a laboratory in Wuhan, China, or was developed there, perhaps inadvertently, by scientists who were experimenting with other coronaviruses, and that someone or an animal became infected with this, and then it got out into the wider population. This is the so-called lab leak theory, which is opposed to the idea that I think most scientists embrace, which is that the virus develops naturally and transferred from a human, from an animal host into a human, and that's how it began. This theory has been, something on the fringes for, I would say, probably for a year or so. Initially, It was very much embraced by senior officials in the Trump administration, and I think was seen as a way for the White House then to try and deflect attention from its own problematic response to the pandemic and point a finger at China. But since then, more and more scientists, including some who had initially been quite skeptical of this theory, have said, look, we're not saying that it did come from a lab, but this question really hasn't been sufficiently interrogated, and it is plausible, and we need to look at it. So that's what the president has done now in directing his intelligences to go examine this question. That's notable, too, because what he's essentially saying is the World Health Organization and other international bodies that would normally do this, he's saying so far have not done a credible enough job because China has not given them access to the information they would need to answer this question. Intelligence agencies won't ask China's permission for this information. They will try and obtain it through espionage and through other means, covert and clandestine. So this is a pretty significant thing for the president to publicly announce that he's directed his agencies to look at. And it shows that there is, I think, a lot of momentum, at least building towards that this lab leak theory should be taken more seriously than it has been.
We should make clear that White House Press Secretary was quick to point out, Jen Psaki, that there is no new evidence here.
What we can't do, and what I would caution anyone doing, is leaping ahead of an actual international process. We don't have enough data and information to jump to a conclusion.
Why is the White House, Dan, at least on the surface, starting to take this theory seriously, despite there being no new evidence to support it?
Well, I think, Jen, some of it is just time. In the case of SARS-CoV-2 or coronavirus, about a year and a half later, scientists still haven't figured out what that animal would have been, that intermediate animal would have been that sparked this outbreak. They haven't found that smoking gun, or to be more specific, that bat in the cave outside of Wuhan, China, that would have been the origin point. So the fact that there are still real questions about when the first people were infected with SARS-CoV-2, like some of the intelligence that Shane and others reported on this week, I think that has stuck with them. We've also moved out of the emergency phase of the response, which allows more reflection on what happened last year, on reexamining assumptions. And as time goes by, we are able to see, and with a new political leadership structure in place, able to look again with fresh eyes on things that were widely assumed in the early days of coronavirus.
Well, speaking of reflecting on assumptions, you just published a piece about how some lawmakers are scrutinizing the CDC's response to COVID-19. What have you learned so far?
Well, I think the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention was in a very tough spot last year. They continue to be in a tough spot this year. We looked to them for guidance, for recommendations, for responding to this outbreak. And there were significant concerns in 2020 that the Trump administration was stepping on CDC. I should know, I broke some of those stories. I came on one day to discuss that reporting, I think, about the meddling in the scientific reports. But as we get farther away from an election year, and as President Trump recedes into the rearview mirror, it does seem that the CDC does have, say, messaging challenges. The mask guidance from a few weeks ago is very abrupt. There wasn't a lot of lead up to that. So the farther we are able to get away from the emergency moment of the response and able to step back, senators like Richard Burr, the top Republican on the Senate Health Committee, they want CDC to look at how it communicates, how it comes up with its guidance. And there is some bipartisan interest in doing this, too. He's far from the only lawmaker looking in on CDC and how it could be improved ahead of the next pandemic.
Dan, before we let you go, I'd like to briefly check in on another epidemic, opioids. Opioid overdoses have shot up 34% since the COVID-19 pandemic, with nearly 200 Americans dying from them every day. What is the state of the opioid crisis? It was already bad, but how much worse has it gotten?
Well, Jen, I think you put your finger on it in that question. There's evidence that drug overdose deaths spiked to record levels last year, more than 90,000, driven by opioid-related deaths. And there was polling that showed more Americans were in mental health distress through the pandemic, people losing their jobs, people not able to get regular check-ins with their doctors. Our colleague at The Post, William Wan, did an entire series about this, about the social isolation and the various shocks, the challenges in responding to the crisis. President Biden had vowed in the campaign that this would be a priority for him. He knows the scourge of drug addiction in his family, too. He has yet to take a few steps, though. He hasn't named what's known as a drug czar, someone who would officially coordinate all of the response to the opioid epidemic. And then this, I think, goes also beyond the opioid epidemic. If you're thinking about shadow epidemics from the pandemic, we don't know yet about missed cancer diagnoses or the effects of delayed care for other procedures. So there will be echoes that we may be living with for a long time.
Do we know whether the pandemic impacted access to substance use disorder treatment?
Well, I think, Jen, there was a moment at the beginning of the pandemic where things were very much up in the air. As the pandemic progressed, there were different strategies and tactics put into place to make sure people could get care in healthcare settings, virtually, and so on. And then the Biden administration has also started to take some steps to try and make care and treatment more broadly available, such as through a drug known as BOOP, buprenorphine, which I always mispronounce. But the idea being that this is a rescue drug in some respects, and more doctors under the Biden administration will be able to prescribe this for people who have opioid use disorder.
Dan Diamond is a healthcare reporter at The Washington Post. Thanks, Dan. Next, more on the News Roundup.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Hint, fruit-infused water with no calories or sweeteners. Hint water comes in over 25 flavors. The watermelon water actually tastes like watermelon. The blackberry water tastes like blackberries. Hint is water with a touch of true fruit flavor. You can get Hint water at stores, or you can have it delivered directly to your door. When you buy two cases, you'll get a third case free and free shipping. Visit drinkhint.com and use promo code NPR at checkout.
What happens after a police officer shoots someone who's unarmed? For decades in California, internal affairs investigations, how the police themselves, were secret. Until now. Listen to On Our Watch, a podcast from NPR and KQED.
Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Joe knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult.
We're talking with Eva McKend of Spectrum News and Shane Harris of The Washington Post about the week's top headlines on the News Roundup. President Joe Biden met with members of George Floyd's family at the White House to mark the one-year anniversary of Floyd's death. And during this private meeting, Biden expressed a renewed commitment to the police reform bill bearing Floyd's name. Floyd's brother, Philonis, spoke to reporters after the meeting.
This is the thing. If you can make federal laws to protect the bird, which is the bald eagle, you can make federal laws to protect people of color.
Shane, what's in this proposed police reform bill?
Well, what we've got right now are a number of different provisions that would do things like, probably most notably, ban the use of chokeholds by police, which we've seen used in other circumstances, including fatal incidents that the police, where they have, you know, used these chokeholds and someone has died. Also, it would strengthen federal civil rights laws. It would create a national database to track officer misconduct. The big sticking point, though, and this is where Republicans and Democrats are at loggerheads, is over this issue of qualified immunity, which is essentially taking that away would make it easier for individual law enforcement officers to be sued over their conduct on the job. This qualified immunity that they enjoy right now, it can act like something of a shield. And this is a place where Republicans want to keep that in place, but Democrats are advocating taking that away, particularly in the wake of George Floyd's death, which, remember, involved more than one officer who's already been convicted in that death. So that's kind of where they are right now. And there was this hope to have this bill done in time for the one-year anniversary of George Floyd's death. But the politics of this have gotten in the way, and you've seen the Floyd family really publicly pressuring the president to do more on this. One of George Floyd's relatives actually wasn't at the White House. She was out protesting and publicly calling on Biden to basically make good on his word and to kind of put pedal to the metal here and get this thing through.
Eva, just give us a better sense of the temperature in Congress right now. How difficult will it be to pass a bill like this, a bill even close to this?
I think it will be tremendously difficult. You know, the red lines on both sides are the same issue. Progressives, Democrats basically think that weakening qualified immunity without doing that, every other issue in the bill has been tried and done before and hasn't worked. When you talk about chokeholds, I mean, Eric Gardner died in New York after that was already addressed. And so they see this issue as the key issue. And then Republicans, they believe that that this is a non-starter. So how do we overcome this hurdle? And I also think that Democrats, specifically progressives, even if they pass any kind of bill without weakening this qualified immunity, even though there are so many provisions in this, from body cameras to prohibiting no-knock warrants, that nothing is going to be good enough. Even if Democrats are able to secure a federal registry, Congresswoman Cori Bush of St. Louis, she said she's not going to be voting for it, and Democrats have to worry about losing those folks in the end. You know, they're really trying to get Republicans on their side in this, but they also have to worry about progressives voting en masse and joining together and rejecting this if they don't get the provisions that they want in this bill.
House Republicans, including Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, are once again condemning comments from Georgia Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene. Her most recent remarks compare COVID mask rules on Capitol Hill to the genocide of Jews during the Holocaust. In a statement, McCarthy said, quote, "Marjorie is wrong, and her intentional decision to compare the horrors of the Holocaust with wearing masks is appalling," unquote. Greene told Newsmax she was blindsided by the public blowback.
He didn't even text me or call me, which is really a shame, before I found out, seeing it in the news, that he had said that. And then sadly, you know, Elise Stefanik, our new GOP chair, followed suit, of course, right along. And then I think Steve Scalise and others. And they shouldn't have done that. None of them called me and asked me what I meant by what I had said.
Eva, why is it significant that these top Republicans aren't standing by Greene here?
Well, I think they felt like they had no choice. You know, she is now become known on Capitol Hill for her provocative, conspiratorial, and at times racist takes, and they want really nothing to do with this. They would have probably preferred to just say nothing, but they probably made the calculation that they couldn't, particularly because Republican leadership has been so vocal about what they describe as the anti-Semitism among progressive Democrats. Of course, you know, progressive Democrats are criticizing the Israeli government, but that's a more nuanced and complicated issue. But basically, Republican leadership didn't feel as though they could continue on sort of just staying silent. I do think that they are worried, though, about the constituency that she represents, right? She every time she engages in one of these episodes, she's able to fundraise off of it. There are a lot of she's popular among a certain section of Republicans, and I think that they constantly balance allowing her to say and do what she wants, allowing her to fundraise and have her fun, and then also they're concerned about, I think, alienating those folks that support her.
Senate Republicans have presented a counteroffer to President Biden's infrastructure bill. The Republican bill would be around $1 trillion, which is the minimum amount Biden says he will accept. Briefly remind us, Shane, what Biden's most recent infrastructure plan includes and how much it costs.
So he had proposed a plan of around $2 trillion. And in addition to talking about funds for roads and bridges and water and airports and the kind of things we traditionally associate with physical infrastructure, there was other things in there for, you know, elder care, for what they would sort of view as human infrastructure. And this became really the big debating point with Republicans as, you know, what exactly is your definition of infrastructure? And I think Republicans saw Biden's initial proposal as far too broad and being both a physical infrastructure bill, but also kind of a social policy legislation. So what you're seeing here is them trying to, the Republican counteroffer is one that strips it down to being more purely about what we think about as physical infrastructure, the kind of roads and bridges projects.
Eva, Republicans have until the end of May to make a deal. How likely is it that they'll make this deadline? And what happens if they don't?
You know, I think that this entire episode has almost become bipartisanship as political theater. Mm. Both sides want to illustrate that they can and are willing to work with the other side, but I do question how genuine that is, just because they remain so far apart on so many of the key sticking points. I mean, even defining what infrastructure is. And we've started to see Democrats put pressure on the administration, on President Biden, to abandon this effort. You know, they say we need an infrastructure bill that meets the moment. There is no benefit to weakening the bill. That is not going to get you any points with voters. That they should do all that they can to have a robust tackling of this issue and spend aggressively. And so I don't see this coming together. You know, surprises happen in Washington, but it will likely move to a reconciliation process overseen by House Budget Chairman John Yarmuth, who I've spoken with about this. He's still saying that he's holding out hope for a bipartisan process. He's not as eager as many of his Democratic colleagues to retreat and jump ship, but he does say that they really only have until mid-June to begin that process, that if they are going to move to reconciliation, a partisan reconciliation process, they have to start it by mid-June.
There was another mass shooting this week, this time at a light rail yard in San Jose, California. Governor Gavin Newsom spoke to reporters later that day.
There's a sameness to this, and that numbness, I think, is something we're all feeling. All of us gathered here today, looking at this scene, listening to governors, mayors, chiefs, speaking similar tone and terms, expression of condolences, all the right emotions and perhaps the right words, but it begs the damn question, what the hell's going on in the United States of America? What the hell's wrong with us?
Shane, what do we know about this latest shooting in San Jose?
It's just a very grim portrait, Jen. 9 people killed, apparently by an employee of the Transit Authority, 57-year-old named Samuel Cassidy, who authorities have described as highly disgruntled. They said he worked at the agency for more than a decade. He died at the scene in an apparent suicide. They said he'd been disgruntled for many, many years, which they believe may have contributed to why he targeted employees there at the Transit Authority. And from what we're seeing from witness accounts, he seemed to go through and tell certain people who were there who thought that they were about to be killed that he wasn't there for them, essentially, and was targeting other people. He was very quick, very efficient in the way he did it. So it appears that this is obviously a very troubled individual who exacted some kind of, I guess, as he saw it, revenge on his coworkers, and it's left 9 people dead. And I think what the governor said, you know, the sameness, the numbness about that, you know, I certainly felt that as well as a reporter who's seen so many of these stories. It almost doesn't even register. You have to remind yourself that 9 people died in this event, and it just feels like something that we've seen on replay for years.
Well, as the shooting was happening Wednesday morning, senators on the Judiciary Committee were sitting in the Capitol grilling President Biden's pick to lead the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives. ATF nominee David Chapman found out about the shooting from California Senator Dianne Feinstein.
While we are sitting here, we have a gunman in San Francisco shooting down people. Mr. Chapman, gun violence is so prevalent in this country. What are the first steps you will take to do something about it, if any?
Senator, I wanted to say thank you for that question, but first, I'm sorry to hear that news. I wasn't aware of that. If I'm confirmed as ATF director, one of our priorities at ATF will be focusing on gun trafficking, the unlawful transfer of legal guns to criminals, and perhaps in this case, a crime like this could be prevented.
Eva, what else was notable about Chipman's hearing?
Well, he's a fierce gun control advocate. He's a 2-decade veteran of the ATF. And so I think that, you know, he is the sensible choice for the administration, who takes this issue very seriously. I think that Governor Newsom really characterized it well when he described this episode as feeling like a rinse and repeat, that the shooting in California really could have been anywhere USA. And so, you know, Mr. Chipman is going to be someone that really prioritizes gun control, and that is something that infuriates Republicans. You know, they are very vocally against him. The NRA has mounted a huge campaign against this nomination, citing his belief that there should be. That there should be more regulation of automatic weapons and his support for universal background checks. But I think all in all, it's not all that surprising. I think the choice of the administration, both the choice of the administration and the pushback that we're seeing.
Shane, what's the likelihood he'll be confirmed?
Oh, it's an uphill climb, I think. I mean, these nominees for ATF have always been pretty partisan affairs, and there's been acting directors in these positions for quite some time as well, so it's tough. You got another flavor of the opposition as well when he addressed at the hearing these apparently doctored images that have been circulating on social media that showed him standing in the rubble of a compound in Waco, Texas, where years ago 76 members of a cult called the Branch Davidians died in a very famous botched raid by federal authorities. And he said, quote, "That is not me." I mean, pointing to these photos, it's not clear how they got out there, but it reflects this opposition. He's being painted as somebody who was present at this event that for some gun rights advocates, and we should say maybe people more on the fringes of this issue, is very much kind of a seminal moment in a rallying cry against federal authority. So to see doctored images of him being placed in that setting gives you a context of where some of the maybe more extreme opposition against him is coming from.
Well, this week, Texas lawmakers passed a bill allowing people to carry handguns without a license, background check, or training. And it was approved in the legislator's first in-person session since a mass shooting that left 23 people dead in El Paso, Texas. Eva, why is this such a big deal?
Well, I think it shows the defiance of Republican state legislatures on this issue, or that we'll likely see from Republican state legislatures as this conversation happens, as the House passes gun control bills that likely won't see the light of day in the Senate, but they're still passing these bills, these Republican state legislatures want to show that they still have power to enact laws to, as in their assessment, honor the Second Amendment.
Well, this week, Florida Governor DeSantis took a stand against tech companies. He signed a bill that bans them from kicking political candidates off their platforms. Shane, just explain what the goal is here.
Well, I think the goal from his point of view is to stop the kinds of, if you will use the term, deplatforming that we saw of President Trump and we've seen in other instances too with elected officials of taking away their privileges to post on Facebook, shutting down their Twitter accounts. That's sort of nominally what he's about. But really what this is it's part of a broader kind of Republican swell now against this idea of big tech and the notion that social media has become like a public square and companies like Facebook and Twitter, when they decide what kind of content to allow on their private networks, are engaging in censorship, akin to what a government might do from stopping you from speaking. So this law would, you know, ban these social media companies from kicking off an elected official. It's hard to see how that's going to square with the First Amendment. I mean, you can't force a company like Facebook or Twitter to violate its own First Amendment rights, essentially, on its platform. So I think that the governor may kind of have things a bit backwards here.
So likely to see some legal challenges ahead. Shane Harris covers national security and intelligence for The Washington Post, and Eva McKend is the congressional correspondent for Spectrum News. Eva, Shane, thanks to you both. Next up, the global edition of the News Roundup.
This message comes from NPR sponsor USC Marshall School of Business. Discover where today's leadership innovations meet tomorrow's critical business challenges. USC Marshall School of Business Executive Education is where business professionals go for lifelong learning and career transformation. The short course, Purpose-Driven Leadership, delivers insights for creating trust, respect, influence, and collaboration while identifying your leadership purpose. Explore this and other programs at uscexecutiveeducation.com. Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Joe knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult.
It's the News Roundup on 1A. I'm Jen White in Washington. Our guests on the Roundup this week are Nancy Youssef, correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. Nancy, it's great to have you back.
Great to be back.
Also with us is Robert Moore, correspondent for ITV News. Robert, thanks for joining us.
Wonderful to be on your show again.
And Daniel Kurtz-Phelan. He's editor of Foreign Affairs and the author of The China Mission, George Marshall's Unfinished War, 1945 to 1947. Dan, thanks for joining us on the Roundup.
Thanks so much. Great to be back.
So first to Eastern Europe. This week, government officials in Belarus diverted a Ryanair plane, forced it to land, and arrested a journalist on board. President Alexander Lukashenko of Belarus insists the plane was forced to land after a bomb threat. Nancy, walk us through exactly what happened.
Well, Ryanair Flight 4978 was traveling from Greece to Lithuania with a prominent Belarusian dissident on board with his traveling companion. The pilots were told that there was some sort of threat and that they had to go to Minsk. This all happened while the plane was over Belarusian airspace. And this dissident recognized immediately the threat, started telling other passengers that he was under threat. They land at Minsk. He is arrested. His traveling companion's arrested. The flight takes off 7 hours later, missing some what many suspect are Belarusian security officials. And he appeared in a video a couple days later under just a duress, apparently confessing to crimes. And it's really sort of been seen as a very brazen act by the Belarusian government. The foreign minister of Greece described it as a state hijacking. And I think it's really sort of challenged people's understanding of what are acceptable international norms, that a government could potentially stage some sort of threat on a plane, force it to land in its country and take off one of its passengers because of his attempts to speak out against the government. And so it's been, I think, a shocking event for Europe and one where the European community now is trying to come up with the kind of measures that it thinks will have impact on President Lukashenko, who has been in power since 1994 and is so far been not very impacted by attempts in the past to sanction him and his country.
Daniel, what do we know about the arrested journalist Roman Protasevich?
So he has had a sort of extraordinary role in the protest movements against President Lukashenko, really since he was a teenager. He's 26 years old. He has, for the last few years, been running an alternative media organization called Necta, which has done a lot of crowdsourcing and use of kind of videos from crowds of protesters to cover protests against the president and in some ways help protesters understand what's going on and communicate among one another. So he's both a journalist, but also a really important figure in the Russian opposition. He was in Belarus for most of his life, but left when he started to understand the threats against him, the danger he was in 2019. So he's been living in Poland, has been running this site, which has been seen as a real threat to this longstanding regime, as Nancy said. And you can understand for that reason why there would be some desire on the part of this rather insecure dictator to eliminate what he saw as a real challenge to his rule.
And what about his traveling companion, who was also taken into custody, as Nancy said, Sofia Sapega?
So this was his Russian girlfriend. They had been in Greece for a conference and a short vacation, I believe. And of course, the other element here is that Vladimir Putin is the protector of Lukashenko. So having this Russian figure there is this added element to the drama. And of course, Lukashenko was meeting with Putin today, really signaling to the Kremlin that he will stand by Russia in what is becoming a flashpoint in tensions between the U.S. and Europe on the one hand and the Kremlin on the other.
Well, speaking on behalf of the Biden administration, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki demanded an investigation into the incident.
This
was a shocking act, diverting a flight between two EU member states for the apparent purpose of arresting a journalist. It constitutes a brazen affront to international peace and security by the regime. We demand an immediate, international, transparent, and credible investigation of this incident. We are in touch with a range of partners bilaterally and through multilateral channels from NATO, the OSCE, UN, EU, and others. And we have nothing to read out at this point, but we will continue to coordinate closely with them.
The U.S. is also calling on Belarus to release Protasevich. But Daniel, how much sway does the U.S. really have here?
So not much is the short answer. The Belarus has in the past really tried to play off the West against Russia, trying to protect its own interests that way. But in the last couple of years, it's really thrown in its lot with Putin. And economically, politically, in a whole variety of other ways, it's much more reliant on Putin than on Washington. So that means that for all the sanctions that the U.S. is going to put in place, for all the demands for that investigation that you'll hear from the Biden administration, Lukashenko really sees his future linked with the Kremlin, and that reduces U.S. leverage quite a bit. The other element is that you'll have Biden and Putin meeting in a couple of weeks, and this will be added to a very, very long list of hard and complicated issues and sources of tension between the two governments. So you'll hear plenty of protests, but it's not likely to fundamentally change the calculation that you get in Minsk.
Nancy, for those who don't follow European news, give us a little more insight into who President Lukashenko is, what type of leader he is.
Sure. So he's been in power since 1994. Condoleezza Rice famously described his leadership in 2005 as one of the last remaining true dictatorships in Europe. And he has really been more aggressive in going after dissidents, particularly after August when there was an election in which he claimed to be the victor by 80% of the vote. He tried to sort of quell opposition, I think, in traditional ways. He arrested opponents. State TV put out propaganda. At one point, there were Russians brought in to sort of punctuate the point. There were internet blackouts, and none of those things worked. And so when NECTA, the channel, was created on Telegram, it was a threat that he couldn't sort of put down effectively because it was operating from Poland and it posed a real threat. And so while state TV was saying that these were small protests, that the election was legitimate, you had a whole network that was developing underneath his rule that was widespread, seen by as many as one-fifth of the Belarusian population, giving in really vivid and graphic detail, the level of abuse, the level of torture, the extent of the crackdowns, in some cases leaking documents. And so he is someone who has had a long-term grip on Belarus, but has been threatened by new ways that opposition is rising, by a fragile economy, and is increasingly, as my colleagues have pointed out, dependent on his relationship with Russia.
It's now been a week since the ceasefire between Hamas and Israel went into effect. And with a truce in place, we've seen a flurry of activity with America's top diplomat visiting the West Bank, Israel, and Egypt. And it's been interesting to hear what he's had to say this week and to whom. Here's U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken speaking before he left for the region on Sunday.
We are committed to giving Israel the means to defend itself, especially when it comes to these indiscriminate rocket attacks against civilians. Any country would respond to that. At the same time, any arms sale is going to be done in full consultation with Congress. We're committed to that, and we want to make sure that that process works effectively.
That's Secretary Blinken speaking to ABC News on Sunday before he left for the Middle East. On Tuesday, he met with Israel's Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, and then traveled to the West Bank for talks with Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas. It was at this meeting that he laid out how much aid the U.S. is planning to provide for the Palestinian people.
This new assistance comes on top of significant support that the United States has recently committed to the Palestinian Authority, to Palestinians. In total, we are in the process of providing more than $360 million in urgent support for the Palestinian people.
Dan, what did you take away from all these talks this week?
So what was extraordinary about what you saw in Secretary Blinken's trip is that after this period in which American policymakers had really tried to distance themselves from this problem, kind of seeing it as one that was not really ripe for a solution. There was not really a chance for progress on Israeli-Palestinian peace. So you'd seen much less attention on it than had been the case a few years ago in American foreign policy. And what this last week, the last couple of weeks showed us is that the U.S. does not think it can really ignore the problem without getting into this sort of crisis. So you saw Secretary Blinken trying to, you know, do what he could to stabilize the situation, to secure the ceasefire, giving promising aid both to Israel for its own defenses and then to the Palestinians to rebuild Gaza and start to make life a little bit better on the ground. But he also was very, very clear that he did not think that this was going to allow progress to some kind of real peaceful settlement. So it's this kind of treading water quality to the diplomacy in this region that requires an incredible amount of time and energy and capital from Washington and from American diplomats, but really just to make sure that things don't get worse, not because there's a lot of hope that things will get much better.
Robert, what did you take away?
Well, for all of those of us who have covered, Gaza from the inside and covered some of the conflict there, and I was there in December 2008 and 2009 for the Israeli ground invasion at that time, it's just incredibly dispiriting because it appears that Israel and the Palestinians are on this sort of 6 or 7 year cycle of bloodletting, this sort of destruction followed by reconstruction. This old schism in the Palestinian leadership remains there between Hamas in Gaza and Fatah on the West Bank. We've got an aging Palestinian leadership. We've got an increasingly conservative and right-wing Israeli leadership. And so I think, as we watch this ritual play out, just as Dan says, this sort of predictable outcome that the U.S. appears to be unable to do anything to avert. We're just left watching this from afar and wondering, how can this conflict ever be adequately resolved? The two-state solution looking, ever further away as a diplomatic prospect. So I think what we're all left with, reporters on the ground, analysts looking at it from overseas, and as Dan points out, as policymakers too, is just how irresolvable the conflict appears to be at this point and how difficult, how forlorn it is for the U.S. to try and, A, provide some munitions to Israel, but then also fund the reconstruction from the demolition that followed the bombing. So it's a difficult and dispiriting situation for sure.
Nancy, Mahmoud Abbas is still the leader of the Palestinian Authority, and he's the person you see. But how much faith do Palestinians have in his leadership?
I don't think much, frankly, and I think this is among the challenges that face the Biden administration. It does not deal with Hamas directly because it's a terrorist organization, yet Hamas has been, from the Palestinian perspective, the most forceful and aggressive and effective communicator of their grievances, that the Palestinian Authority is corrupt, led by an 80-some-year-old man who hasn't been seen as someone who's been able to unite or break Hamas's growing influence for the Palestinians. I think that there was some hope that because one of the things that Hamas does is govern Gaza, that the strikes would sort of break the Palestinian will and create frustration, that they had allowed so much violence to happen within their territories, that 250 people had been killed, including 66 children. But I think in the face of a weak Palestinian authority that has not been able to be effective as a negotiator for the Palestinians, I think the situation is such that Hamas remains an effective partner. And I think one of the ways we saw that was that Secretary Blinken traveled to Egypt. Remember, Egypt was the chief negotiator between the Israelis and the U.S. and Hamas because neither side would engage with them directly. And so I think coming out of this, Hamas is stronger from the Palestinian perspective, and it's not clear if there's an opportunity where you can have a Palestinian authority that is seen by the Palestinians as an effective communicator or advocate for a two-state solution or even dealing with the immediate problems that spurred this, like the possible eviction of Palestinians in Sheikh Jarrah and the tensions at Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Well, Secretary of State Blinken also announced on Tuesday that the U.S. would reopen its consulate in Jerusalem. Nancy, what's the significance of reopening this formal diplomatic channel?
So it's really sort of served as the de facto embassy for Palestinians. And so when it was closed under the Trump administration, it really sort of personified a Trump administration that was sort of shunning the Palestinians and really moving more towards Benjamin Netanyahu. So I think this is sort of an outer display of a U.S. that wants to be seen as more neutral in this conflict and to shift a little bit away from Netanyahu vis-a-vis President Trump's position. And it also is an opportunity for engagement in a very sort of direct and literal way that didn't happen in the past. And so I think what the administration was trying to show is the U.S. is changing its position. It wants to be seen as someone that can be engaged with on behalf of the Palestinians, that the U.S. position is not as supportive of Netanyahu as it was under the Trump administration.
We're rounding up this week's news with Robert Moore, correspondent for ITV News, Daniel Kurtz-Phelan, editor of Foreign Affairs, and Nancy Youssef from The Wall Street Journal.
What happens after a police officer shoots someone who's unarmed? For decades in California, internal affairs investigations, how the police themselves, were secret. Until now. Listen to On Our Watch, a podcast from NPR and KQED.
Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Joe knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult.
We're discussing the world's biggest news stories this week with Nancy Youssef from The Wall Street Journal. Also with us, Robert Moore, correspondent for ITV News, and Daniel Kurtz-Phelan, editor at Foreign Affairs. Well, this week, President Biden called for a ceasefire in the Tigray region of Ethiopia. In a White House statement on the seven-month-long conflict, he said, quote, "The large-scale human rights abuses taking place in Tigray, including widespread sexual violence, are unacceptable and must end." The statement went on to say, "The United States is committed to helping Ethiopia address these challenges, building on the long-standing ties between our two nations in working with the African Union, United Nations, and other international partners," end quote. Dan, catch us up. What is this conflict about?
So this was a conflict that started right around the time when Americans were distracted by the drama around our own election. The roots of this go back to the previous Ethiopian government, which was led by the Tigray People's Liberation Front. It was then displaced by Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed a couple of years ago. Abiy Ahmed was probably most on people's radars for winning the Nobel Peace Prize a couple of years ago from ending another conflict. But as political tensions between the TPLF and Prime Minister Ahmed started to mount and those tensions grew, he launched this offensive into Tigray, which is this region in northern Ethiopia, which has really created this terrible humanitarian catastrophe in the seventh-month war, as you said, which has involved abuses not just by the Ethiopian army, which is a recipient of a lot of American aid and support, but also by lots of other allies, including the Eritrean army, including sort of irregular forces that are aligned with the government that are committing lots of these abuses that you referred to in your question. And what you see from the U.S. is, during the Trump administration, I think a little bit more resistance to getting closely involved in these kinds of conflicts abroad. And you see this return to, a more traditional kind of American diplomacy, where it's seen as the role of the administration to try to do what it can to get a ceasefire in situations like this.
Nancy, why did the U.S. pick now to weigh in?
I think a couple reasons. We saw reports of atrocities. CNN had a really detailed report about people being beaten, pushed out of displaced camps, reports of rape, humanitarian workers being killed. And I think it created put a spotlight really on sort of the level of violence and the amount of sexual assault in particular that is happening in that region. We've seen hundreds of thousands displaced in this time. And it was so graphic in terms of how they described it. And then a humanitarian worker was killed just in the last week. So I just think there was a feeling that the level of violence and our awareness of that violence had really ramped up. Remember that throughout this conflict, journalists have not been able to see the way I think many would think. A New York Times journalist, for example, was just forced to leave in the last week. And so it's not been easy to get a window on what is happening there. And so I think that was part of it. And also that the U.S. has a special envoy for the Horn of Africa, and that there's an opportunity now potentially to have that envoy, Jeffrey Feltman, travel back with a president who wants to see a dialogue begin such that we can see a potential end to this conflict.
Well, let's move away from the Horn to Central Africa. Goma is a city in the Democratic Republic of Congo and home to around 700,000 people. Residents there are still reeling from the eruption of Mount Nyiragongo this past weekend, and their troubles aren't over, unfortunately. Large parts of the city have been evacuated because of fears the volcano will erupt again. Robert, what impact has this natural disaster had on the city?
Well, I've had several reporting assignments in my career to Goma. The bleakest of all was after the 1994 Rwandan genocide, when tens of thousands of Hutu refugees fled into Goma and died all around us of cholera. Really traumatic scenes. And Goma, you know, is a bleak and blighted city at the best of times. And now it has, in addition to the political violence and the economic desolation, it's got this great sort of geological disaster that's unfolding once more. Mount Nyiragongo is regarded as perhaps the most dangerous volcano in the world. It lies just north of Goma, just a few miles north of it. So it's got a major but very impoverished city at its foot. And most distinctively, it has this lava lake in its crater, highly active. And there's always the fear that it has this sort of frightening chemistry, if you like. It can lead to a sudden release of deadly carbon dioxide and methane. And I think in the last 24 hours, there have been new fissures showing that possibility exists again. So in a way, it's not just the danger of lava, it's also carbon dioxide and methane. And understand that, you know, at the foot of this volcano is this major city of over a million people with a really poor infrastructure. There's no easy evacuation plan or resettlement plan. So, you know, it is this kind of perfect storm, if you like, of a natural disaster compounded by politics and desperately poor economic conditions as well. So no wonder that people are there pleading for the international community to give Goma and this natural disaster more focus and more attention.
Well, in a case between Royal Dutch Shell and climate change activists, the activists came out victorious this week. The Hague District Court ruled in favor of Friends of the Earth International, saying Shell needs to reduce its emissions 45% by 2030. Mark Carney is the UN's special envoy for climate action and finance, and he told CNN it was a sign of things to come.
There needs to be a dramatic reduction in greenhouse gas emissions for heavy emitters, and there's none more so than in the fossil fuel industry. The best companies recognize that, and they're changing their business strategies. If they don't, they're going to end up with very large stranded assets. So the ruling is in the direction of what companies need to do anyways.
So, Nancy, how significant is this ruling? And just explain what it means.
So I actually thought it was fascinating because this was brought forth by seven activist groups on behalf of 17,200 Dutch citizens. And one thinks of a lawsuit against a company that one would be seeking damages or say that the company needs to adhere to a certain law that it's broken. But this didn't seek damages. It really sought, above all else, a change in policy and adherence to a global policy, in this case, the Paris Climate Agreement. And so the court ruled that Royal Dutch Shell had to reduce its carbon emissions by 45% by 2030 from its 2019 levels. And that's much higher than the company's aim of reducing them by 20% in that same time period. But it's the first time we've seen that a court has ordered a company to comply with a policy versus just a law or to pay out damages. And so this was seen as a major win for those who want to hold private sector accountable for their impact on the environment. The challenge with this is it's not clear how one can enforce this, such a law or such a ruling, excuse me, or who would monitor it. And so is it Does it have teeth behind it? We'll have to see over time. But I think it's an interesting development that of a sort of global policy rather than requiring companies to adhere to a law in a particular nation state.
Well, that wasn't the only shakeup we saw in big oil. Shareholders for ExxonMobil voted to install two board seats backed by Engine Number One. That's a climate-friendly activist fund. And we should note ExxonMobil is an NPR funder, but we cover them like we cover any other company. But Robert, explain exactly how this happened.
Well, Jen, you're right to connect the two, because it does appear to be a kind of victory, if you like, for climate activism, because Exxon is now going to find itself with two new board members. One of them, Kaisa Hietala, is a well-known sort of business executive in Europe with a background in the energy sector, and regarded as somewhat transformational because she did push her previous Finnish company heavily into renewables. So it puts into sort of, I think, you know, into clear light that there is going to be a growing fight between shareholders who have concern about climate change and more cautious, conservative American corporations who are keen to ensure that their kind of fossil fuel sector of their business stays intact. So like in Holland, which of course is a country kind of uniquely vulnerable with its low-lying territory to climate change, we are going to see, I think, in different forums, whether it's fights at boardroom level or fights at the courtrooms, that there is going to be this increasingly sort of titanic and consequential clash between activism and corporate interests.
Dan, to your mind, what does this say about what shareholders and consumers want from energy companies?
I think what's so extraordinary about the Exxon vote, especially, and then another one from shareholders at Chevron, who similarly expressed their dissatisfaction with the moves that Chevron is making to diversify and address climate change, is that it's not just about activism, it's not just about concern over climate change, but it's about concern over the business model of these companies. So you had BlackRock, the biggest money manager in the world, supporting the activist shareholders. That's in part because of concern about climate change, but probably more than that, it's because they think that over time the business model of fossil fuel companies is going to become increasingly unprofitable. These companies have seen their shares drop quite a bit over the last few years as climate change activism has become more prominent, as you've seen shifts away from fossil fuels and to renewable energy. So the fact that this is driven by the profit motive and not just concern for the fate of the world, in some ways is to me the more important change that you saw yesterday. If that really is what's going to force change from some of these companies, that may end up being more powerful than the concerns you see from groups like Friends of the Earth, which drove the change in the Netherlands.
Well, Robert, if we continue to see changes like this at energy companies, what do you think that might mean for the way we see a shift in politics around this issue?
Well, I think Dan is right. I mean, the politics is going to change as business models change. And I think on both sides of the Atlantic, climate activists are feeling energized and empowered, both with this court victory in Holland and with board victories here in the United States. So I think it does underline how activists are feeling that, like, you know, there is momentum behind them. The wind is at their back, and I think Dan is right to identify kind of the business model as perhaps the key element here. I mean, it might be that within a few years, companies and activists find themselves kind of on the same side of the fight, and in that case, of course, you know, we're in a much better shape to achieve some serious reduction in carbon emissions.
Let's turn to COVID. India remains the new epicenter of the global pandemic. But earlier this month, cases fell below 200,000 for the first time in months. On Tuesday, the New York Times published four charts in the hope we might better understand what India's real figures are. Nancy, can you take us through these four charts?
Sure. Let me begin by saying there was a report released by the World Health Organization that estimates that the global death toll from COVID is 2 to 3 times higher than reported. Mm-hmm. And this includes countries that have good systems to keep track of patients and have good data. And now we're talking about India, a country where the health system is weak, where there isn't good record keeping. And so there has always been an assumption that the official numbers, which as of today are 318,000 plus deaths and 27.6 million cases, was underreported. And what the New York Times attempted to do was to try to get at what that real figure is, and using surveys of those who have antibodies in addition with official data. And the numbers are startling. I think we knew this talking to families from India. I know that in my own family that the numbers never sort of seemed to reflect what we were hearing. But these charts really kind of punctuate the point. To give you a sense, their best case scenario is that the numbers are 15 times higher. That's the best case scenario. And the more likely scenario is that 1.6 million Indians have died and 535 million have been infected. This is a country of 1.4 billion. And so what the numbers do is really sort of codify this idea that this is a crisis, this is a humanitarian crisis happening in India and hitting every sector of it. And even this survey is somewhat limited in what it can do, because the diversity of India is such that if the survey doesn't properly go over the country, it could be off by tens of thousands either way. But it's the first attempt to really put a number behind, I think, those of us who have been following the events in India know, but have never seen accurately reflected in the numbers.
Well, we plan to talk more about this next week. But Dan, in a week where America passed a vaccination milestone, 50% of all adults being vaccinated, how is the rest of the world doing?
So those two events are closely related in that there's this growing debate about how much the United States should be doing to help vaccinate the rest of the world. So you see, you know, a fair amount of progress. You see cases declining in lots of places that have had similar success at vaccinations, whether in the UK and parts of Europe. Cases in India are finally declining, it seems, if we can trust the number, to the extent we can trust the numbers. But at the same time, you see. New concerns in East Asia, you know, in places like Japan and Taiwan that have been doing quite well. You see new concerns in parts of the developing world that were not hit as hard early on. And this has really given rise to fears that as the virus circulates over time, new variants will arise that will, you know, come back to hurt populations in the U.S. and in Europe that have already been vaccinated, because the vaccines might not be quite as effective against the variants. So there is this new concern over what a real global strategy would look like to overcome COVID. And part of that's going to be the United States and European governments really helping get vaccine doses to governments elsewhere that are less able to pay for them, to distribute them, to produce them. And that's going to be a key part of the fight in the months and probably years ahead.
A reminder, our guests this week for the roundup are Daniel Kurtz-Phelan, editor of Foreign Affairs, Robert Moore, correspondent for ITV News, and Nancy Youssef from The Wall Street Journal. Well, UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson was roundly thrown under the bus by his former chief advisor, Dominic Cummings, earlier this week. And he wasn't the only one. During a 7-hour hearing, Cummings made a series of explosive claims about mistakes made by the British government during the COVID pandemic. Here's some of them.
In February, the Prime Minister regarded this as a scare story. He described it as the new swine flu. I've come through here to the Prime Minister's office to tell you all, quote, I think we are absolutely I think this country is heading for a disaster. I think we're going to kill thousands of people. When the public needed us most, the government failed. And I'd like to say to all the families of those who died unnecessarily how sorry I am for the mistakes that were made and for my own mistakes at that.
Robert, who is Cummings and what reaction has there been to his testimony?
Yeah, well, trust Britain to produce a midweek political drama on that scale. Dominic Cummings is the architect of the Brexit vote. He was until recently Boris Johnson's closest advisor, sometimes called Britain's second most powerful man. He is admired by some and feared by almost all. He's kind of an eccentric, maverick advisor who was at the absolute heart of Number 10 Downing Street. And these claims about Boris Johnson's handling of COVID were absolutely stunning. I mean, as you heard there, accusing the Prime Minister of unnecessarily killing tens of thousands of people because elderly patients were released from hospital and put into care homes without being tested for COVID. He accused Boris Johnson of being unfit to be Prime Minister. He accused Matt Hancock, the British Health Secretary, of being a serial liar. So it was spectacular stuff. And, you know, the only thing I think to use a metaphor that perhaps is appropriate, is what has inoculated Boris Johnson in this case is Britain's highly successful vaccine program. So Boris Johnson is able to brush some of this off by saying, look at the results of our vaccine program. That is not chaos. That's excellent organization and shows the British state did well. But nevertheless, you know, there's no question that after that comments to that House of Commons committee, Boris Johnson is damaged. He's intact, but damaged. Although the national mood in Britain perhaps is not for a post-mortem now, but to move on and to get it to, you know, summer vacation. So there is a sense in Britain that however damaging this is for Boris Johnson personally, the country doesn't want to go through this lengthy post-mortem. It wants to get back to normality.
Well, this week, the small Pacific Island nation of Samoa elected its first female leader. On Monday, Prime Minister-elect Fiamme Noemi Mataafa showed up to form a new government, but the doors to parliament were locked. The prime minister took her oath during a makeshift ceremony in a tent. Nancy, what's the story here?
Well, the country had its elections April 9th, and it's been contested ever since. It was a narrow election result, and basically there were court battles back and forth between the current president, who's been in office for 22 years, whose party has been in control for 40 years. This is a country, by the way, it's only 55 years old since independence. And so there were members of the Speaker of the Parliament was on the side of the former president. There were court battles back and forth, and they finally agreed on at the last minute under their constitution that she had won. She goes to the steps, and the Speaker of the Parliament had ordered that the doors where the ceremony is supposed to take place were locked. And so they had to set up a tent in the lawn, and that's where her inauguration happened, and what's being described as a bloodless coup and by her team and the president, the past president, saying that she's not the legitimate leader. And so an island where we don't think of political conflicts erupting, an island that doesn't, whose government doesn't have a military, is now facing a political crisis as it tries to sort out governance. And I think the ultimate takeaway is that this will become a winner-take-all for a country that appears to be divided politically for the first time in its history.
Well, Fiamme is the first woman prime minister in Samoa. Daniel, what do we know about her?
So she is was affiliated with the previous government for a period of time, but then has challenged the incumbent president, and among other things, has challenged him on his deal with China to have the Chinese government build a port, which is becoming a bigger flashpoint in politics in the South Pacific. And just to bring it around to the first story that we started with, where you have the U.S. and Russia vying for influence in the smaller, or fighting over Belarus, and that becoming a flashpoint in U.S.-Russia competition. Here you have the U.S. and China increasingly concerned about the influence of the other in the South Pacific. So an even smaller country has become part of this broader competition between the U.S. and China, and that has become this flashpoint in Samoan politics. So among lots of other local issues, you have this geopolitical significance.
That's Daniel Kurtz Phelan of Foreign Affairs. Also with us this week for the roundup, Robert Moore, correspondent for ITV News, and Nancy Youssef from The Wall Street Journal. Nancy, Dan, Robert, thanks for your time. 1A's lead audio engineer and sound designer is Jake Cherry. He gets technical assistance from Mike Kidd, Ben Privett, and Rashad Young. Aileen Humphreys is the producer and editor of 1A On Demand. Chris Castano is our digital editor. The podcast is produced by Barb Anguiano. 1A's managing producer is Paige Osborne. Our senior producer is Jonquilin Hill. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening and have a great holiday weekend.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Hint, fruit-infused water with no calories or sweeteners. Hint water comes in over 25 flavors. The watermelon water actually tastes like watermelon. The blackberry water tastes like blackberries. Hint is water with a touch of true fruit flavor. You can get Hint water at stores, or you can have it delivered directly to your door. When you buy two cases, you'll get a third case free and free shipping. Visit drinkhint.com and use promo code NPR at checkout.